two cases before us this morning, two appeals. We have the case of Claude Melieu versus American Transportation and Uninsured Employers Fund, and all counsel are here on that. And then we have a second case where I think we'll just be hearing from Mr. Swiger, and that's the American Transportation appeal. Is that your understanding, gentlemen?
That's from Mr. Dumar. That's the American Transportation appeal.
I'm sorry. I knew I was going to do that. Mr. Dumar, you're absolutely right. On that appeal, we'll just be hearing from you. Is that correct, then?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, with regard to the American Transportation and Uninsured Motorist Fund, each side has 15 minutes. So, Mr. Dumar and Mr. Main, I don't know if you want to split that or how you want to do that, but you'll have a total of 15.
Yes, Your Honor, we're going to split that time evenly between the two of us.
Okay, great. May I ask you to just keep track of that then so I won't have to tell you it's 7.5 minutes?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, terrific. Okay, as I said, you've got 15 minutes each. Mr. Swiger, you are the appellant. Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, ma'am. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Certainly. Okay, and we are all set then whenever you'd like to proceed.
May it please the court, my name is James Swiger. I have the privilege of representing Claude Melieu with respect to this Virginia workers' compensation case, which involves what appeared to be an uninsured employer and the uninsured employer's fund. This matter was initially heard by Deputy Commissioner Cummins. Mr. Malieu was a commercial driver and on this particular day of accident was operating what was popularly referred to as a party bus, one of those limousine buses that seats approximately 24 passengers plus the driver. We concede Mr. Malieu was not wearing his seatbelt at the time of this accident. What happened in the accident was he was returning the group of partygoers back to their destination, whereupon the bus was rear-ended by what turned out later to be a drunk driver who fled the scene, was later convicted, sort of not related, other than that Mr. Malieu lost control of the bus. This was southbound on 95, just south of the Wharton exit, going towards Woodbridge, Virginia destination. The bus hit the guardrail on the right side. It rode the guardrail approximately 120 feet, and then it rolled over. During the course of the rollover,
this is Judge Alston, and I always appreciate the fact that counsel tries to take advantage of his 15 minutes as best he can, and so I would like to, if you don't mind, identify what I believe may be the core issue in this case, and let me go through the four-part test that's out there. Number one, the rules reasonable, the employee knew of the rules for the employee's benefit, and the employee intentionally performed the forbidden act. And it seems to me from reading the brief that the first three criteria that are used to assess, you pretty much agree with the assessment that the rules reasonable, knew of the rule, and the rules for the employee's benefit, and that your concern relates to the last part of that four-part test, and that the employee intentionally performed the forbidden act. Is that a good summary of your argument, sir?
No, sir, Your Honor. Actually, the sole argument that we're making is that the employer failed to prove that my client's injuries were proximately caused by his failure. We acknowledge that he was not wearing a seatbelt. We did not appeal that portion.
Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me for interrupting, but this is Judge O'Brien. But just following up on your answer to Judge Alston here, that you are not contesting that he was in willful violation because of the encounter he had with the police officer. You're conceding that he was in willful violation, but your issue is proximate cause.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's, in fact, to distill this to its very essence, that's solely what our argument is.
Okay.
That was the burden of proof of the employer in this case, and they failed in that burden. And let me just point out that this was something, and unfortunately I didn't articulate it as well in my brief as I would like to. I think I preserved it, but I went back and sort of the basics. I've been practicing law 37 years, and I think we all sort of develop an instinct, judges and lawyers, for what proximate cause really means. But on further investigation, when I went back and actually looked at the definition as per the Supreme Court of Virginia, proximate cause of an injury is a cause that in the natural and continuous sequence produces an injury. Now, this is the important part, which I think Deputy Commissioner Cummins and Commissioner Marshall touched upon, and which is the basis of the prior two decisions of the full commission, which we relied upon. This is this last part of the definition. It is a cause without which the injury would not have occurred. That is something that the employer has to prove in this case. You can see from the photographs and from the testimony, this was a catastrophic accident. The previous precedent of the commission was, in a catastrophic accident, the burden of proof is still on the employer to prove that it was the willful violation of the safety regulation that caused the injuries. But when you have a case like this where the injuries were certain to have been caused, whether he complied or not, then the employer has to prove which injuries, if any, they can proximately establish were related to the failure to wear the seatbelt. And that is the crux of our entire case in this particular appeal.
Now, ultimately, that proximate cause is a factual finding. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And you would agree with me that I understand that the deputy commissioner ruled in favor of your client, and then the full commission reviewed the evidence, and that's a de novo review, right?
That's correct.
No, okay.
Well, yeah, that's correct. That is correct.
Okay. But your assertion is that the employer was required then to show by medical evidence, I believe, is alluded to, at least. Let me ask you that. Are you asking?
It's certainly one of the ways that it's typically proven, Your Honor, is you have a doctor opine that here's what injuries are related to the failure to wear the seatbelt. And it is proper, and it is proper in cases, and I concede that in my brief, where factually it's proper to infer that from the way the accident occurred. The most striking case is that UPS case, which is cited in my brief, where the UPS driver did not collide with another vehicle, but because in order to avoid colliding, he slammed on his brakes and he was thrown from his seat into the street and sustained his injuries in that fashion. It was certainly reasonable in that case to infer that his injuries were directly related to not wearing his seatbelt. In this case, we have a multitude of injuries. And again, if you look at the catastrophic nature of the collision itself, or the rollover, it is virtually impossible, which I would posit, which is exactly why the uninsured employer's fund and the employer either failed or decided actively not to adduce medical evidence, because it was impossible. But it's their burden of proof, not my client's. And he sustained a multitude of injuries, some of which may be related, may not be, but we don't know that. What the commission relied upon was, at page 105 in the appendix, was a question by Mr. Maine, my client. He said, one more question about the accident. Before you went from the driver's seat of the passenger seat, had you sustained any injuries that you were aware of while still in the driver's seat? And he said, not that I'm aware of. He said, no, not that I'm aware of, no. And so how can you draw a reasonable inference from that question and that answer that his injuries were related to his failure, all of his injuries, or which particular injuries were related to his failure to wear the seatbelt? That's the crux of our appeal. I have
counsel,
nothing further to add unless the court has questions.
Counsel, let me follow up on that just a little bit. And your opponent colleague argues that employee's violation of the rules established protecting his own safety or well-being, which breaks the causal chain between the injury and the accident, bars an award of benefits. What would be your response to that, sir? And it suggested that that's an intervening proximate cause of the injury sustained.
I'm not sure I understand the court's question. We concede that he was not wearing his seatbelt. We're not saying, and I don't think that we're not, and we're also agreeing that they don't have to prove that the accident, or they don't have to prove that the accident was caused by his failure to wear the seatbelt, but rather his injuries were caused by the failure to wear the seatbelt. That's where I think they have, it's virtually impossible for them to prove that. And I think the commission impermissibly inferred that his injuries were related simply because he was thrown from the driver's seat. But Mr. Malyu didn't testify that he was injured when he was thrown from the driver's seat.
So your suggestion then that to prove its case on the employer's standpoint, that it was incumbent upon the employer to present evidence to suggest, and I'm just using this by way of example, if he had not been wearing this, if he had been wearing the seatbelt after being thrown from the bus, he wouldn't have broken his shoulder. If he had worn his seatbelt, he wouldn't have fractured his ankle. If he had worn his seatbelt, he wouldn't have had this particular injury. That is the employer's burden to establish what things would not have occurred but for his failure to wear the seatbelt. And,
yes,
and the employer in this instance did not do that.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. Again, the example I used in my brief was, what happens if Mr. Malyu had hit a concrete abutment doing a lawful speed limit, so let's assume it's 70 miles an hour, where you just have this catastrophic damage to the bus, where the whole front of the bus is shoved into the back, but yet he's not wearing a seatbelt. How can the employer possibly prove in that kind of case, which I would say is factually similar to this, could they possibly prove that his injuries were proximately caused by his failure to wear the seatbelt versus just the catastrophic nature of the accident? And that has been the law. And that was Commissioner Williams' two decisions that I've cited in my brief and that Commissioner Marshall cited in his dissent and which was relied upon by Deputy Commissioner Cummins. That has always been the law before the commission, that the employer has to prove that. The claimant does not have that burden of proof.
Okay, then. You have 5.5 minutes left for rebuttal. Would you like to save your remaining time?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. All right. Mr. Dumar, would you like to start then, sir?
I think Mr. Main and I agreed that he would start.
Certainly.
For the response, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Mr. Main, happy to hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Justin Main. I represent the Uninsured Employers Fund in this matter. The full commission found in a split decision, 2-1, that the claimant's injuries, and I'm quoting here, were a direct consequence of his failure to comply with the employer's rule and the cited statutory mandate, end quote. As Your Honor alluded to, this is clearly a factual finding. I don't think there's any disagreement among everyone that's the case, and therefore this is subject to the credible evidence standard of review. Mr. Swigers argued that there really is no evidence whatsoever to support this factual finding, and then there's also an argument that there should or must be medical evidence regarding the injuries that were caused by his failure to wear the seatbelt. I would respectfully disagree with both of those contentions. First, neither the willful misconduct statute nor the case law that interprets it requires that proximate cause in a willful misconduct case be proven by way of medical evidence. Can it be proven by medical evidence? Sure. Would that be nice? Yes. But must it be proven by medical evidence? No. So I just want to get that out there. I think there's other avenues that you can meet your burden of proof on the proximate cause issue in a willful misconduct case. And I'll concede that we don't have any medical evidence in this case that on the issue of proximate cause. But what we do have is we have credible testimonial evidence, and it's largely from Mr. Malou. I still can't pronounce his name after all these years, Malou himself. And I just kind of want to take you through the handful of facts that I think get us to that credible evidence standard. The first is that the seatbelt in this case was in good working order on the day of the accident. And
Counsel, if you could, if I could interrupt you for just a bit, and I'm trying to focus a little bit on your opponent colleague's argument. Do you agree or disagree that it is the employer's burden of proof to show that the injuries that were sustained were related to the failure to wear the seatbelt?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, 100%. There's six elements of a willful misconduct when you get to enforcement and proximate cause. That's all, the employer or the uninsured employer's own burden with respect to all of those issues.
Okay, and if that is indeed the case, and there is no evidence in the record that I've been able to discern, if you could help me find the evidence which suggests that the employer has met its burden in that regard.
Of course, Your Honor. So I think there's seven facts that get us to that burden. The first, which I was just mentioning, is the seatbelt was in good working order on the day of the accident, and the claimant had worn the seatbelt earlier that day. That's page 86 of the transcript of the joint appendix, and the owner of the company also testified to that, page 124 of the joint appendix.
And I agree with you that there's a lot of evidence to support the conclusion that the claimant was not doing what he was expected to do by company policy. I guess my question relates to what evidence do you have regarding causation regarding the injuries sustained?
So the reason I mention that is that I think they're kind of tied together, and so I'm kind of want to take you through the order to get to where that proximate cause fact is, just to kind of speed things up for you. The claimant or the driver has acknowledged that the seatbelt is designed to keep him safe, that it's supposed to keep him in a seat. I think we all can agree on that. That's just a common sense thing. We know he wasn't wearing a seatbelt on the day. That's conceded. What we know that he was ejected from the driver's seat to the passenger seat when the bus rolled over the guardrail. And from there, he was ultimately ejected out of the bus entirely. So that's an important fact, I think, on proximate cause. After he was ejected from the bus, he ended up underneath the bus's engine, another important fact. And then I think the last and most critical fact is that, and this is what Commissioner Newman pointed out in the opinion, is that prior to the driver being thrown from the driver's seat, he testified himself that he had not sustained any injuries. And that was my question to him at the end, and I asked him that question, quite frankly, because I knew proximate cause was going to be our hardest issue. And, you know, if he hadn't been injured, if he had been injured at some point during this accident that's unfolding while he's in his seat, I would agree that that would be hard for us to prove proximate cause. But he wasn't in his seat. He was ejected from his seat because he didn't have his seatbelt. And at that time, he wasn't injured. So I think the logical conclusion, if you take all those facts together, the logical conclusion is that all of his injuries were sustained after being thrown from the seat, which was because he was not wearing his seatbelt. So therefore, all of his injuries were the result of his not wearing his seatbelt, and they were numerous, and there were many injuries. And I don't – opposing counsel has said that we need to show which injuries were the proximate cause of his failure to wear a seatbelt, and it's my contention that it's all of them, because he had not sustained any injuries prior to being thrown from that seat, and that's the critical fact.
Counsel, let me interrupt you, and I believe that your opponent colleague is going to come back with this. That question, which I believe is a very good question in the context of the taking of the evidence, could be read to say, what was your condition prior to the accident? And he said he could have, opined that I was fine before the accident. So I guess the question could be read to suggest one or two answers. One, how were you before the accident, and how were you as the accident was occurring, if you understand my point?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm pulling up that question.
Page 105 of the appendix.
Thank you, Mr. Swire. So the way that I interpreted the question and the way that I thought it was pretty clear when I asked it was that, just prior to leaving that seat, before you went from the driver's seat to the passenger seat, had you sustained any injuries that you were aware of? And he said, not that I'm aware of, no. So, to me, that is the critical fact. I think that is the, from there, that's the fact that the full commission hinged on in deciding this case. And it's a small fact, but it's a very critical fact. And I think there's a lot of speculation from the dissenting commissioner's opinion and from opposing counsel about, this was a catastrophic accident, he would have been injured regardless. Well, that's all speculative, too. We're all aware of catastrophic accidents where people walk away without a scratch. Do I know if that would have happened here? No, I don't. That's an impossible burden to prove, and what I feel like the dissenting commissioner opposing counsel is trying to do is put an impossible burden on us with respect to proximate cause. I mean, this was a case where he knew he was supposed to wear a seatbelt, he didn't wear a seatbelt, he was ejected from the seat and hadn't been injured up until that point. And I think those are the facts that get us to the proximate cause finding. And for those reasons, I'd ask that Your Honors affirm the full commission decision. And I'm gonna stop since I only had about 7 minutes. I'm going to let Attorney Dumar take it from here. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dumar.
Thank you. May it please the court, this is George Dumar. I'm the attorney for American Transportation Company, Inc. in this matter. I think the key issue is resolved – to a large extent by the case of that the court's focused on by the Buchanan v. Pro-Industrial Welding case. Aside from Emory v. UPS, which was a case that denied benefits at the commission level, I think that's been discussed a little bit, where the driver was thrown from the vehicle and the commission inferred that the injuries occurred due to the failure to wear the seat belt because he was thrown from the vehicle and subsequently injured. A case that is actually even more similar to this one at the Workers' Compensation Commission from 2012, which we cited, Buchanan v. Pro-Industrial Welding, had another case where a driver, a commercial driver, was not just thrown from the vehicle, but kind of thrown around the inside of the cab of the vehicle and out, kind of very similar to this. And the court again denied benefit because of the failure to wear a seatbelt causing the injuries. In fact, the driver had kind of similar to Mr. Mailou tried to claim that if he had worn his seatbelt, he might have been worse off or still been injured or not been able to get assistance if he was still stuck inside the cab. And in fact, the court said, look, there's evidence that you were thrown from the vehicle, that the injuries occurred once you were thrown from the vehicle, and that was sufficient to show that the failure to wear the seatbelt was a proximate cause of the injuries claimed on. There was no requirement to show or parse out each and every specific injury, as Mr. Swiger is suggesting here. So I think if you look at...
Mr. Dumas, this is Judge Alston again. And I appreciate your argument. It seems to me that in this kind of case, we don't have our traditional analysis. You have a two-part analysis, one where you got to go through the traditional proximate cause for liability, and then there's this sort of unique thing where you need to have proximate cause for damages, which, according to the case law, the way I read it, the employer bears the burden of proof of proving causation with regard to damages. What specific medical evidence is there in this record which suggests that the employer has met its burden of proof regarding causation as it relates to the damages in the case?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of specific medical evidence. There was no, and I think that if I had to look through the records again, there certainly an accident, certainly there's references to the accident, to the fact that the driver wasn't wearing his seatbelt, but the medical evidence doesn't split out exactly the proximate cause the way the law does. That is, I'm not aware that the medical records parse out what is caused by the accident, which is a but-for cause of the injuries, but is not the proximate cause under the law, Your Honor. I think that based on Buchanan and Emory, that the failure to wear the seatbelt, those are failure to wear seatbelt cases, they're the proximate cause here, and like the situation in those cases, the fact that the injury occurred once there was an ejection from the vehicle, and despite arguments that there might have been similar injuries if at least in Buchanan, or another injury if the driver had kept his seatbelt on, I think that was sufficient to show that the proximate cause of the injuries generally was caused by the failure to wear the seatbelt, and that's, I think, on all fours here. The cases cited by the commissioner, in particular Williams and Connor, actually discuss mostly the driver's awareness of the seatbelt rule. These cases, reading through them yesterday, were primarily about whether the driver was really aware of the seatbelt rule, whether the employer really had seatbelt rules. And the court the commission in both cases sort of found that there wasn't a clear seatbelt rule that the driver was aware of, and then sort of threw in the fact that proximate cause wasn't proved either. But I think for those two cases, the main issue was whether the driver was even aware of the seatbelt rule. Those are the Williams and the Connor cases that are cited by the deputy commissioner. So I think the The bottom line here is that the ejection from the vehicle in Buchanan was found to have caused the injuries generally as a matter of proximate cause. I think here the driver did testify that he got injured, what was not injured before he was thrown from the driver's seat. So I think just like in Buchanan and just like in Emery, it was a reasonable inference for the commission to draw that he was, if he'd worn his seatbelt, that that he would have not been injured. And I think that's, or at least that the, to the extent that the seatbelt failure to wear it, and it was willful, there's no dispute about that, failure to wear the seatbelt willfully was a proximate cause of his injuries. And I think that the law in Buchanan and Emery is on all fours with that. And
let me ask you this, sort of a hypothetical, just to kind of parse your argument. It's a very good argument, but let me ask you this question. Suppose you had a situation. Suppose you had a situation, heaven forbid, where a person that's in this situation, working for his employer, did not have the seatbelt on, and was ejected from the vehicle, and the vehicle landed on the claimant in that case. And the indication was that death was instantaneous. As soon as the bus fell on the person died through the traumatic injury that was caused by the bus falling on top of him. Would the employer in that instance meet its burden or not?
That's a good question. Well, here, the employee...
I try to ask good questions.
That's a tough question. I knew a tough question was coming, but because the employee wasn't there to testify in that case, it would be hard to know if the... be hard to know even if the employee was wearing the seatbelt, not presumably wasn't wearing the seatbelt, but then there'd be no way to establish the employee's knowledge of the rule by the employee's testimony. It would be hard to parse that part of the statute out to know whether the employee was aware or not, and that does seem to be the primary test. But certainly, you know, at some point, I believe actually that the employer probably could meet its burden. I mean, I think it would be a closer call without the employee to testify as to when the injuries occurred, but I think theoretically, Your Honor, if the employee, you could infer, a court could infer, a fact finder could infer that, in fact, the injury would not have occurred but for the employee being thrown from the vehicle. He wouldn't have ended up under the vehicle. And in that circumstance, I think the employer could still meet the burden. I mean, there may be circumstances where the employee could not meet the burden. I mean, if there's the vehicle is absolutely crushed and destroyed, turned into a cube, yeah, certainly at some point, Mr. Swiger's example, at some point you could construct a hypothetical where there's the failure to wear a seatbelt is just not a factor. Here, that's not the case because we have the employee's own testimony as well as the facts of how the evidence occurred and really what happened. So the answer is, I think, thinking about it, yes, if an employee was thrown from the vehicle and ended up under the vehicle, that would not have happened but for the employee not wearing a seatbelt that led to that circumstance. And so I think that's not totally dissimilar from here, but I think the existing case law with Buchanan and Emery is quite clear that the employer here has met the burden of the willful misconduct statute, and the Williams and Cummins cases are really addressing the employee
Mr. Dumas,
yes.
Your time is up, but I'd let you go a couple minutes over because I wanted you to be able to answer Judge Alston's question.
All right. Thank you, Madam Clerk.
You're welcome. Thank you. Mr. Swiger, would you like to use your rebuttal time then, sir?
Yes, ma'am, if I may.
Certainly.
I would like to point out to the court that I think Mr. Dumas is exactly wrong with respect to the reading of Emery and Buchanan. These cases are, by their very nature, very fact-specific. Emery was the case where the UPS driver was thrown from the truck when he tried to stop the truck suddenly. Clearly, that is a reasonable inference, since he was thrown to the ground and broke his arm, that had he been restrained, his vehicle was not damaged. One fits the other. In Buchanan, the claimant actually testified that that his injuries were resulted from being thrown inside the truck cab as the vehicle drove off the road. That is a fact-finding in that case, and the commission found that in that case. The two cases relied upon by the deputy commissioner and the dissent, Williams and the Say case, those were both rollover cases. And in both of those cases, the full commission did say, as a matter of their decision-making, that the severity of the impact of the overturned truck was too much to discern whether there was proximate causation. This case turns not on the but-for causation, but on the proximate causation. That is the legal part. That is, it is a cause without which the injuries would not have occurred. If the court reads Mr. Malheur's statement at his answer to Mr. Main's question at Appendix 105 to create a reasonable inference that's his injuries all occurred because he fell from the driver's seat into the passenger seat, then I guess I lose this case. I take the position that's not a reasonable inference. The way his answer is worded, it merely establishes a chronology of when his injuries when they occurred in time, that they did not occur after the first vehicle struck his while they're riding down the guardrail, that it was actually when the catastrophic part of the accident occurred when the vehicle rolled over. So we take the position that they have failed in their burden. We believe the statute requires, by its very terms, no compensation shall, this is 65.2-306, no compensation shall be awarded to the employee for an injury caused by their willful breach. So they have to prove what injuries were caused by his willful breach. I think it's an impossibility in this case. That's why they didn't attempt to adduce medical evidence, because they knew they couldn't. And it's their burden of proof, not the claimant's. And therefore, I think because they have the burden of proof, they failed in that. The commission drew an impermissible inference from that one statement, and we stand on our position.
Thank you, Mr. Dumar. Okay, that will conclude the first case we have. And thank you very much. And I think, Mr. Swiger, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Swiger. And I had this little chart for myself. I wasn't very efficient, I'm afraid. But I think that will just move us then to the second case. And Mr. Dumar, I'm happy to hear from you, sir. Other counsel, you are welcome to end the phone call.
Thank you. I take no position in that matter, and therefore I will terminate this call with
terrific.
A
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
all.
You, certainly. Okay.
Your Honor. This is Mr. Main. I don't take any position either, but if it's okay with you, just because of the work I do for the Uninsured Employers Fund, I'll stay on for this portion.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly. Certainly. Okay. And now, Mr. Dumar, we're happy to hear from you.
Well, thank you. I think on this issue, I think it's a question of whether my client was fined excessively in this case. And I, frankly, I found that the... on the failure to have workers' compensation insurance, that there seemed to be, based on my experience, a very excessive fine for my client's failure. He testified at the time that it's a small business owned by him and his wife, that, in fact, he had thought he didn't need the insurance because he used independent contractors.
Let me ask you a question about that, sir.
Yeah.
I understand that he testified that he did not believe that he needed insurance, and then this accident occurs, obviously, and he's made aware that he does.
Right.
He did not actually get coverage, though, until 3 years after the accident.
Yeah, well, he testified that he did get the coverage, and I hashed that through with him yesterday, and I don't know if this is possible, but apparently he got coverage, but he got it in Maryland. So he delivered to me yesterday a declaration of insurance that provided for workers' comp insurance, but he got the coverage in Maryland. If he had, in fact, gotten a Virginia endorsement, his office and his main facility was in Maryland in 2013-2014. He got his workers' comp insurance through, he just got regular insurance that included workers' comp insurance. I just sent this to the clerk because I just got access to it yesterday, but I think this was the source of my client's confusion. English is not his first language. He didn't fully understand it, but he got insurance. He just got it in the wrong state. He got a policy that covered him in Maryland. I would ask that this certificate of insurance, which I sent to Mr. Swiger and Mr. Main earlier today and sent to the clerk's office at least, it would be allowed as some evidence of mitigation here, because I think that otherwise his fine is really excessive, and I think the commissioner assumed that he was just lying about it, getting insurance after the accident or around the time of the accident, and that led to this really, really high fine. I thought the fine maximum was $5,000, actually, for the failure to cover. Apparently, it's been raised at some point to, $50,000. But, I thought the applicable statute was 65.2805, which I thought was a $5,000 fine. Here we had $25,000, and I would argue that my client was just, he's not a native English speaker, was a small business. He was confused. He wasn't lying, but I didn't really have the evidence to show that until yesterday. And I think the problem...
Mr. Dumas, I think Judge O'Brien, Judge Attlee, and I have all had the pleasure of practicing law before we got the opportunity to be judges, and sometimes the things our clients do absolutely drive us crazy. And you,
No question, Judge.
You're stuck with what they do, but essentially what we have here, and I would like your thoughts on this, is that if we were to say that this fine is inappropriate, wouldn't we be essentially substituting our view for the view of the deputy commissioner, and aren't we kind of constrained from doing that?
Well, I don't think so. I think this is a matter of fine as a matter of law, Your Honor, what the fine would be. And I think there is this newly discovered evidence that I think would have certainly calmed down the commissioner in the sense that she would not have been thinking my client was just an out-and-out liar here on something. And he wasn't. I think he doesn't fully understand English perfectly. He's certainly well enough to testify. He should have been clear in his testimony. He should have gotten me documents ahead of time that would have, if I'd had this certificate of this deck page earlier, I think I wouldn't be here if I'd had it at the level of the deputy commissioner. But I think that's a matter of law, and I think the court can consider as a matter of law whether the fine was appropriate. And so generally, I understand that the commissioner has some latitude, but I think the questions of fines are a question of law as a general matter. And so I do think that there's this giant piece of new evidence in terms of the fact that he got workers' comp, he just got it in the wrong state, and I think that would ask the court's permission to submit that document formally to provide some evidence of at least mitigation on this point.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. If there's nothing further, we will certainly consider the argument. And my apologies again for mixing up the names.
Thank you, Madam Clerk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This will conclude the conference, or the argument. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Madam Clerk.
Bye-bye.